This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have right here in the studio with me Deepa Kumar. She's an associate professor of media studies and Middle East studies at Rutgers, author of Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire, which is just about to come out, right?
Yes.
You can also read her blog at empirebytes.com. That's bytes with a Y. Deepa Kumar, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Am I pronouncing your name right?
Perfectly.
Oh, excellent. I'd like to start off by getting your reaction to a couple things that have been in the news lately. First is the revelations about the NYPD doing this third jihad film. Of course, the story broke in 2011, but it came out that they were lying about it, that not just a couple times did it run, but it ran on some continuous loop. And, you know, more than 1,000 officers at the New York Police Department saw this hideous, racist film about Muslims. What does that tell you?
Well, this is not the only instance. This is one instance where it's got some play that a group of right-wing extreme racists have actually been able to pose as educators to the law enforcement community. So the New York case is one that we've heard of. But in fact, if you look at some of the investigative reporting that's been done by Public Research Associates and Thompson Cota, they did a nine-month investigation into three organizations, the CI Center, INCOTA, INCTOA, and SSI. These are three organizations that conduct courses. They conduct counterterrorism courses. And you look at their staff, and these are some of the most rabid Islamophobes that you can ever come across. And they teach people things like, you know, there are no good Muslims. All Muslims in the United States are involved in a conspiracy to take over this country. They want to institute Sharia law. This will be a huge violation of human rights, civil rights, and so on and so forth. And so that's been actually happening quite systematically over the last several years. And only recently, of course, is their attention now being paid because it started to come to light. And so it's alarming that this is what's happening.
I mean, it's one thing for them to put on these courses for whoever is going to attend, but then for a government agency, whether it's the Pentagon or whether it's a police department or whether it's Homeland Security, to endorse it, and clearly it was endorsed in New York City because the commissioner, Raymond Kelly, was interviewed for it. He said originally that he wasn't and that they had taken old footage and recycled it, but turns out he knew exactly what he was doing and sat down with the producers for 45 minutes. It's hideous. What do you think the impact is on officers who see such a thing?
Right. I want to actually start with what you said earlier, and that is that these people actually are not some fringe element. They're not somebody outside of the mainstream. What gives a video like Third Jihad credibility is it has former CIA directors like James Woolsey as part of the narrative. It has Rudolph Giuliani. It has, you know, Kelly and so on and so forth. And so I think the important point here is that these people are not some fringe elements. They're not, you know, I think to borrow a page from David Kaut, who's written this fabulous book called The Great Fear, McCarthy wasn't some sort of out-of-control senator. He was part of a system that relied on a politics of fear in order to persecute the Cold War. In the same way, these people are very much a part of the security establishment. They're very much a part of the foreign policy establishment. They inhabit think tanks and so on. And so they are on the inside, not on the outside. Now, the question is, what consequences does this have? Well, the Associated Press actually recently did an expose last July 2011, where they found that there were mosques and Muslim communities and so on were infiltrated. Spies were planted. They were called mosque crawlers, if you will. And the very same people, imams and others who had been working with the law enforcement community, Rudolph Giuliani would trot out people who were helping, you know, in the struggle against terrorism and so on. Those were the same people whose mosques were infiltrated and who were being spied upon and so on. And this is just complete, you know, it boggles the mind that an entire community of people can be placed under suspicion in this fashion. and there's very little accountability. And it really harks back to what was done to Japanese Americans after Pearl Harbor. Over 100,000 people of Japanese descent were put into concentration camps, and that's exactly what's been happening to Muslim Americans in this country. You don't have to be guilty. You're guilty just because you're Arab or just because you're Muslim.
Yeah, they're not in camps yet, but they are. The presumption is that they are. That they are guilty without proof. And in New York City, as you were suggesting, there were these efforts by former CIA agents who the New York Police Department hired from the CIA to conduct these undercover operations, the sweepers, the crawlers. They were going not only to mosques, but to restaurants and any gatherings where there were Muslim Americans. It was total mass guilt. Mm-hmm. Entire communities assumed to be guilty. And then you mentioned Woolsey. Woolsey's interesting because he was a former CIA director, and I think he was Project for a New American Century, too, if I'm not mistaken. And so, you know, there's this, what is the foreign policy angle? You've got a book coming out, Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire. Why is it so useful or suitable to those who want to advance the United States empire to be inculcating this Islamophobia?
Yeah. The neoconservatives have actually been sort of at the leading edge, if you will, of constructing this enemy of the Muslim, the Islamic terrorist, right? And this goes back all the way to the 1980s, when two very important conferences were held, one back in 1979 in Jerusalem, which the current Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu organized, in which they tried to come up with this language of terrorism and to implicate terrorists, people who were enemies of Israel in particular, with the Soviet Union and urge governments around the world to take this threat really seriously. And you had a whole bunch of dignitaries from eight countries around the world, including several members of the Reagan administration and so on, attending this. Then we come to 1984, and this terrorist has become the Islamic terrorist. And Muslims in particular have become demonized. And it's because of the Iranian Revolution of 1979, when, of course, Khomeini is the great evil monster against which, you know, all sorts of prejudicial ideas get cultivated, but also the birth of Hezbollah in the early 80s, and then later in the 80s, Hamas and so on. So Islam and terrorism get linked together. And then coming out of 1991, there are two strands in the policy, foreign policy establishment, in terms of what role is the United States going to play in the post-Cold War era. And on the neoconservative side, there's an essay by Charles Krauthammer, who's the editor of Weekly Standard, and he writes a piece called The Unipolar Moment, which is published in the preeminent foreign policy journal, Foreign Affairs, in which he puts forward the neocon vision, which is, we're now in a unipolar world. The U.S. has just got to assert its hegemony around the world and use military means wherever necessary to create a world in its own image, right? Now, of course, when these ideas were first put forward, you know, the Pentagon also released a policy paper like this. It was seen as ridiculous. You know, we can't possibly do this. The other wing of the foreign policy establishment said, we're going to change the world, but we're going to do it through the language of humanitarianism. But suffice it to say that both wings are committed to the idea of projecting U.S. power around the globe. 9/11 provided that opportunity. As Condoleezza Rice famously put it, the tectonic plates of the world are shifting. We've got to seize this opportunity. And so there was consensus between both the liberal imperialists as well as the neocons that they should take advantage of this. And what better way to do it than to have this image of this deadly terrorist Islamic menace from which to go off and wage war in Afghanistan? And of course, Iraq had nothing to do with it, but it's the same kind of ideology that greases the wheels, if you will, of the war on terror. So my argument is that Islamophobia, which is anti-Muslim racism, is the ideological handmaiden of the war on terror and of U.S. empire.
I'm speaking with Deepa Kumar. She's associate professor of media studies and Middle East studies over at Rutgers. She's the author of this upcoming book from Haymarket Books, a real good publisher of left-wing progressive books. Books called Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire. This kind of identification is still with us of Islam and enemy. And it surfaced recently when Newt Gingrich, not my favorite person, was criticizing President Obama for defending other religions instead of our religions or our religion singular. He didn't define what our state religion is here in the United States, but this idea that a leading political figure of a major party can be talking like that is should be shocking to people 10 years after 9/11.
Indeed. Actually, you know, part of what's happened over the last 2 years is that some of the most extreme rhetoric around Islamophobia has actually been allowed to come into the mainstream. So it doesn't surprise me that Newt Gingrich, who actually jumped on the bandwagon in relation to the so-called Ground Zero Mosque controversy, this was the proposal to build an Islamic community center, 2.5 long blocks away, by the way, from the site of the former World Trade Center. And Gingrich and Palin were some of the first people to jump on this bandwagon. This controversy was generated by Pamela Geller and Robert Spencer of Stop Islamization of America. And these people jumped in, and Newt said something as ridiculous as, we would not have a monument to the Holocaust next to the Nazis next to the Holocaust Museum, you know, as if to say that all Muslims somehow are to blame for the events of 9/11, and therefore any symbol of Islam, such as a community center, is just so offensive. So in the 2010 elections, it wasn't just Gingrich, it was a whole slew of politicians who used this form of racism as a way to advance their electoral campaign. It didn't work. But scapegoating has always been one of the tools of the far right, and so it's not surprising that these politicians would use it. But to come back to what you started with, which is Obama, if you look at what happens towards the end of the Bush presidency, it's clear that their strategies, the neocon strategy, is not working. The war in Iraq is a failure. The war in Afghanistan is dragging along, and so on. So by 2006, 2007, they've actually shifted gears, and they're now talking about winning hearts and minds, counterinsurgency. This is the Petraeus document, doctrine, and so forth. And there's an excellent video called The Human Terrain System, where they recruit anthropologists, cultural anthropologists, to go off and gather information to better subjugate the colonizers. Right? So this is the effort that's going on. And there's a policy group that gets formed under the leadership of Madeleine Albright and Richard Armitage and others who have devised a plan for how to rescue the image of the United States in the quote-unquote Muslim world. And part of what they say is we need a president who denounces the clash of civilizations rhetoric, which is the idea there's the East and there's the West and, you know, it will always clash, which was the main ideology of the Bush administration. We need someone who makes enough gestures to show that the United States is such a wonderful country that it can regain its legitimacy. And indeed, that's what he does. His acceptance speech, as soon as he's inaugurated, he talks about the United States as being, you know, a country made up of Muslims and Christians and so on. I believe that was the first time such a reference was made. And then he goes off to Cairo and gives this speech denouncing the clash of civilizations rhetoric and so forth. But I think that, you know, close to 90% of the Muslim American community voted for Obama, and they thought that he would actually push back against this rhetoric. But the fact of the matter is he's adopted a bunch of, you know, the Bush administration's agenda, both abroad as well as domestically. He pushed the war in Afghanistan further to include Pakistan, the number of drone strikes, and so on. So as long as you continue the policies of the war on terror, you may not call it the war on terror, you need this ideology, you need this rhetoric to continue.
It's interesting, though, because then he'll get whipsawed by the right wing, by Gingrich, even by Romney, for so-called apologizing for the United States and not standing up for the United States as the country that can do no wrong and has never done anything wrong. So he's kind of caught in the middle there. But let's look at Obama a little closer, because when he was running for president, you know, people were saying the right was always a Muslim. And, you know, he never stood up and said, you know, I'm not a Muslim, but if I were a Muslim, there's nothing wrong with being a Muslim. Muslims can be presidents, too. And I think he consciously stayed away from going visiting mosques, though he'd go to churches and synagogues. So it wasn't exactly that he just stood up there and defended mm-hmm. the pluralism that is at the heart of the United
Absolutely.
States. And then it's, you know, McCain, the same thing. He was asked on the campaign trail, and you have in a chapter of your book that I saw on the web, I remembered this, I'd forgotten it briefly. A woman says to McCain at a McCain rally, "Obama, he's an Arab, isn't he?" And McCain said, "No, he's a good family man."
Yes.
Which was such a bizarre and racist answer.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, and then to the policy, you were talking about the policy, Deepa Kumar, about Obama, and he has this policy of assassination. You can assassinate anyone around the world, including a U.S. citizen.
Mm-hmm.
And he's done that. And the National Defense Authorization Act, of course,
That's right.
He signed, which says the president or the Pentagon can round up American citizens and send them to Bagram Air Base if they want
indefinitely.
To. So, I mean, these are things done by a so-called liberal president, Democratic president, and yet those are, as you put it, in keeping with what the Bush administration has been doing. I'm wondering if we could go to another frontier in Islamophobia, and that is U.S. culture. And to what extent that has influenced attitudes, which are shocking because after more than 10 years after 9/11, people have more negative attitudes toward Muslims than they did months after 9/11. That's crazy. But culturally, what have the impacts been? There was 24 on Fox. There's this new show, Homeland, which is kind of a modified 24. Talk about that a little bit.
Right. I want to actually start a little bit before 9/11 to talk about the impact on culture, because it's not as if anti-Muslim racism and stereotypical representations of Arabs and Muslims started after 2001. You know, Hollywood, in fact, has a long history of vilifying Arabs, particularly. You go back all the way to the 1920s, and you see films like The Sheik with Rudolph Valentino and so on. And this is nothing if not the idea of, you know, the white man's burden and all the rest of it. The Sheik is this brutal guy who, you know, violates this white woman who needs to be rescued, etc. So these images, you know, have existed for a while. But I think at least prior to 9/11, there were contradictory images. That is, culture doesn't automatically follow politics, but politics sort of sets the limits for what is possible in the cultural sphere. So it's interesting that in the 1980s, I mentioned earlier that the image of the Islamic terrorist is one that's being cultivated in the political sphere. In the cultural sphere, in Hollywood and television and so on, this image gets reproduced in all sorts of ways. And, you know, there's a complete and total vilification of Arabs and of Muslims and so forth in relation to Iran as well. But interestingly, you look at a film like Rambo the Third, Rambo Part Three. It was a top grossing film. It was released in 1988. The week it was released, I believe the first film was Crocodile Dundee, number one on the list, and the second was Rambo the Third. And you look at that film, and it is dedicated to the Mujahideen. This is the holy warriors that the U.S. funded to the tune of $5 billion that was fighting the proxy war against the Soviet Union. And there are so many of these guys who are, you know, presented as really sympathetic characters and so on. And Ronald Reagan actually referred to them as freedom fighters, akin to, you know, our founding fathers and so forth. So it's not surprising that you have these contradictory images at the same time. But that gap begins to narrow as the Soviet Union collapses. And historically, the U.S.'s attitudes towards Islamist organizations has been that they cultivated them to the extent that they were a bulwark against secular nationalists and against the left parties in the Middle East and North Africa and so on. Once they were no longer useful in that capacity, of course, the more negative image is the one that starts to develop. So that's the background leading up to 2011. And of course, after 2011, you mentioned 24. There's also a show called Sleeper Cell. And it really sort of, you know, legitimizes some of these racist notions that people like Steven Emerson, who made this film called Jihad in America, it was aired on PBS of all places, and their whole conspiracy that Muslim Americans are in these sleeper cells, they're conspiring, there are no moderate Muslims and so on, those sorts of attitudes have been reinforced. That said, we have had some decent films like Syriana, and so on, which involves some progressive people, you know, behind the effort and so forth. But yes, for the most part, culture, unfortunately, does follow politics, especially when we have a cultural industry that relies on the government to set regulations that make it profitable for this industry, both domestically as well as abroad. And of course, there's a long history of cooperation between the Pentagon and Hollywood in particular, and the co-sponsoring and the joint production of films and television shows and so on.
Speaking with Deepa Kumar, she's the Associate Professor of Media Studies and Middle East Studies at Rutgers. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. You've got a chapter in your book about the myths, five or six myths about Islam and Muslims. Do you want to run down a couple of those?
Sure. Since we haven't talked about Muslim women, maybe I'll start with that one. But in 2001, apart from revenge being given as the excuse to go off and make war with Afghanistan, of course, the Taliban didn't have anything to do with the events of 9/11. As the Guardian newspaper reported, they were willing to hand Osama bin Laden over, provided he was tried somewhere outside of the U.S. And Bush said, thank you, but no thank you. We're all set to come and bomb you and so on. So the other justification, the other rationale, is that the United States needs to go off and rescue Afghan women from Afghan men. And sadly, many progressives, including feminist organizations like the Feminist Majority, went along with this rationale. And they should have known better because they knew about the collaboration in the previous decade between the Taliban and, for instance, the Clinton administration, because UNOCAL wanted to build a pipeline to access Caspian Sea oil. And so anyone who's willing to establish stability in Afghanistan should be worked with. At least that was the rationale back then. So unfortunately, progressives went along with this idea. This was an idea that, you know, the neocons put forward because they actually are defenders of human rights. And so the liberal imperialists and the right-wing imperialists came together with this story and people bought it. And it's really unfortunate because this is not the first time that such a rationale has been used. There's a long history of colonial and imperial nations actually pretending to go off and rescue what Gayatri Spivak put it as rescuing brown women from brown men, right? And so one example of this would be in the 1880s when Britain invades and occupies Egypt. And Lord Cromer, who oversaw that occupation, essentially said, we're here for a number of reasons, but we also think that Islam is just so terrible and that we want to rescue these poor Muslim women from, you know, the rot that Islam is creating and so forth. And of course, you look at who Lord Cromer is and what his role is back in the United Kingdom, and he just coincidentally happens to be the founder and president of the Men's League to End Women's Suffrage back in Britain. So obviously, this is not really about women's rights. It's about what kind of story can be told that uses human rights and women's rights and so on to grease the wheels of empire. And in this line was used in India against Sati, which is, you know, when a woman is killed after her husband dies and so on and so forth. And what I try to do in this chapter is to expose this myth and to show that never, not in one instance, has a colonial power or an imperial power actually gone out and rescued women, or for that matter, any other group of people that they want to. And furthermore, I think the other side of this is some of the idea that Islam is uniquely sexist. And in fact, that's not true. All of the world's religions are sexist. They all came into being at a time when sexism was rife and still is today. Nicaragua, for instance, banned abortions even in cases where a woman was raped. And this happened barely 4 or 5 years ago. This is a Catholic nation and so forth. And so the idea that somehow Islam has a monopoly on misogyny is a completely distorted view of world religions. And I try to debunk that as well by pointing not just to the history of sexism in Christianity and Hinduism and so on, but even, you know, one of the originary moments when Islam first came into being in the 7th century in Arabia, the practices of veiling and segregation and so on actually didn't exist for the most part in the region where Islam was born. It's only when it spread to the neighboring Christian Byzantine Empire and to the Persian Empire and so on, where these practices of segregation, veiling were far more prevalent. It's from there that those practices got incorporated into Islam. So, you know, one of the icons is of women's oppression is to see a woman who's wearing a burqa, a niqab, a veil of some sort, and automatically assume that she's oppressed. Well, first of all, the origins of these practices go back to Christianity. And furthermore, it should be a woman's choice to decide what she wants to do. And so part of the argument is to really, if one is a feminist, then if anything, one should believe that a woman should choose what she should wear rather than have some paternal figure tell her what to do. And that's why I'm against the French ban on the veil. I'm against the French ban on wearing religious, well, they called it, you know, wearing all religious garb in schools, but in fact, it was just an attack on the veil. Canada recently has been trying to pass similar sorts of measures. These are, you know, these are paternalistic, anti-women measures, in my view.
It's interesting because still with the United States floundering in Afghanistan, you still hear some liberal arguments or defenses or apologies for staying there because we need to help Afghan women.
Absolutely. And it's unfortunate because there's a really good book by the former Afghan MP by the name Malalai Joya, where she documents quite clearly that, in fact, since the U.S. has been in Afghanistan in 2001, the condition for women has deteriorated. In some urban centers, some women have enjoyed more autonomy and freedom, but for the most part, Afghanistan is rural. And for rural women, the situation has deteriorated alarmingly. And this is because the people who replaced the Taliban, the allies of the United States, the Northern Alliance, these were the same people who came to power back in 1991 after the Soviet Union was routed. The Mujahideen would then fight one another. There were several factions of the Mujahideen, and eventually they would form a government. They are the people who actually started the attacks on women's rights, which the Taliban then took to a whole new level. And so to put these people back into power and to call them allies of the United States, what else do you expect? And I was really struck, one of my friends who used to work as a correspondent for the Wall Street Journal in Afghanistan, he told me the story of how this young woman who had been raped by one of these Northern Alliance commanders had been trying to get justice in the court system. But the very same people doing the raping and the molesting and so on are also wearing judges' robes during the day. And so there's absolutely no justice, which is so ironical because at least when the Taliban were in power, as horrible as they were, women could get some form of justice under their system. But now even that doesn't exist. And so this young woman set herself on fire and killed herself to make a statement. And so these things, tragically, they don't come to light. And instead, some organizations and some feminist groups that go there talk mainly to elite women in the cities who have an interest in having the U.S. remain there and don't talk to the vast majority who aren't available readily to talk to them.
We have about 1 minute left. I just briefly wanted to ask about the Arab Spring and what that did to contradict a lot of these misconceptions and prejudices about Islam.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the myths about Arabs is the idea that they can never bring about change. Despotism is the only form of governance that they're actually suited to. And so what we saw really is this myth being shattered in no uncertain terms. Young men, women, middle-aged men and women took to the streets, made their own history. And as long as we are talking about women, I mean, some of the leaders of this movement were actually women. And it's their calls on YouTube, their leadership on the ground and so on that actually led to the Egyptian revolution being successful, the Tunisian revolution and so on. And, you know, I joke about this, but I give talks about the representation of Muslim women. And I have to say that the Arab Spring has just made it so easy for me to give these talks because there's all these fantastic images of women, even in full hijabs, battling the police, standing up for themselves and asserting themselves as agents capable of change.
Well, that's a nice image to end. Unfortunately, we're out of time. My guest today has been Deepa Kumar. She's a professor at Rutgers, author of this upcoming book from Haymarket Books called Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire. Deepa, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you so much.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.